microscopic example, which therefore is only partly useful. Okay? I would like to know at this point, before we go any further, I am not a physicist, and the last couple of questions have raised some very good questions in fundamental physics, which I don't claim to understand as deeply as I'm sure there are other people that do. Have we any physics people in the audience who would like to make some comments on either of the last couple of questions? If so, I'd very much like to hear from them. I try.
All right, well, thanks. I have a question that I'm afraid is terribly simplistic, but nonetheless, I would like to explain.
Please, don't ever start out a question, this is a dumb question, because then it looks so bad when I don't know the answer. You know? Besides which, the dumb questions are usually those really profound ones with the only answer to which we don't know the answer.
Okay. You speak of two points. We'll say they're like thousands of light years apart.
Okay.
Yet you say when we get up near the speed of light, we can traverse the distance in only a few seconds.
A few seconds of our time, yes. Because the Lorentz-Fitzgerald contraction, see, they're moving past us real fast from our point of view. So the Lorentz-Fitzgerald contraction has gotten them much closer together than they were when they weren't moving with respect to us, i.e. than when we started moving the outside of everything. And so that cosmic ray is able to cross the galaxy in 5 minutes of its own time, because the galaxy, from its point of view, is moving past it so fast that Lorentz-Fitzgerald contraction has shrunk it from 100,000 light years across to being only 5 light minutes across.
All right. Thank you.
Grip?
Okay.
Are you watching over the microphone?
If we start at the starting point, Earth, move away from it. Now, subsequently, the Earth sends out electromagnetic pulse, time pulse, inside it, a record player.
Okay.
First off, what are the relative clocks that each will measure? What will the Earth think the spaceship's clock is, and what will the spaceship think the Earth is doing?
Could you state the problem again, because I'm not sure I caught everything you said there.
Okay, let's just start with the spaceship leaving the Earth at high speed.
Spaceship leaving the Earth at speed high compared to other points.
Okay. Now, when the Earth looks at the spaceship, what does it see happening to its clock? Slow, right?
That's right.
Okay, and vice versa for the spaceship looking at the Earth, is that correct?
After it's finished accelerating, it's as simple as that, yes.
Yes, okay. Now, what will be the speed of light as it started from the Earth, in other words, shot from an antenna on the Earth, past the spaceship, as the spaceship measures it?
186,000 miles a second.
So let's say within that...
186,000 is the spaceship's miles for the spaceship second.
Okay. So if in that beam is a time pulse, what will the spaceship measure in the time pulse of the... in other words, if they play a record, how will it hear it? Will the frequency be shifted on the record or what?
Yes, it will.
But it's going by at the right speed, so how come this frequency is
That's shifting? The difference between phase velocity and group velocity. The waves are going by at a speed of 186,000 miles a second. Modulation of the waves travels at a different speed from the speed of the waves themselves.
Excuse me.
I'm going to walk too.
All right. Waves have that property in general. The particles that make up the waves on the surface of a pond are moving at speeds very different from the speeds of the waves themselves.
But that's the modulation of those waves.
The modulation is also. That's the difference between phase velocity and group velocity. See, the other story, a science fiction story, by the way, in which that kind of thing happens, and that is one of the juvenile novels of Robert Heinlein, which, if you are into science fiction, you probably know are better than 99% of most of the supposedly adult literature that's been written. And this particular one is called Time for the Stars. He assumes several things that are probably not valid, and knows that, you know, and is just writing a story about what would it be like if they were. For one thing, he assumes that telepathy exists and that it travels faster than light, which in fact would lead you, in fact that it travels instantaneously, and that would lead you into all kinds of problems, but it is, which Heinlein does not duck.
at one point, one of the characters tells the hero of the book, the only logical consequence is the time and space do not exist. And the hero says, then what is it we seem to be having breakfast in? And the physicist looks at him and she says, just a mathematical abstraction. Poor sentimental Tommy, you worry too much. I'm sorry. Hold on a second here while I get my microphone back on. Okay, you still reading me? It is nevertheless an interesting story in that respect because some of the things that you're talking about actually occur. And you can hear them go by.
Just slightly. Let me make my modulation just, I can't think what it's called, the radio, just the presence or the absence of the signal itself.
Okay, a carrier wave.
Carrier wave.
Yeah.
It's code modulation.
No, I think he just means he wants a simple sine wave and more information on it.
No. Continuous wave modulation. You can put a lot of information across on that, depending how fast you turn it on and off.
Let me show you what would happen. You send out a pulse, let's take the simplest kind. You send out a pulse of a certain length of nothing but simple sine wave. Okay? Let's suppose it's three wavelengths. At a particular instant, it looks like that. At another particular instant, let's see if I can do this right, it might look like this. The wave crests are traveling at a different speed than the ends of the train. One is called the phase velocity, the other is called the group velocity, and they're not necessarily the same.
I'm not sure that answered the question before.
Okay. Other questions?
No.
Okay. Hey,
you mentioned something in relation to elementary particles, and relating to tachyons, that a particle with a certain charge moving backwards in time would be equivalent to a particle with the opposite charge moving forward in time.
Right, and having the same mass and so on.
Right. Now, what I would like to know is, since we have observed antimatter, mm-hmm. have we ever observed a particle of antimatter at rest?
Oh, yes.
We have.
Oh, yes. At rest in space.
Well, at rest relative to our reference frame
yes,
that we measure.
Yes, at rest in space, but that's not a rest in time. I guarantee it was moving forward in time at the same rate, I mean, it seemed to be moving forward in time at exactly the same rate as you and I, or else we would have seen it for just an infinitesimal instant and then it would have disappeared.
All right. I guess what I was trying to get at was, could some of the antimatter that we have observed today sort of be like a tachyon?
No. It doesn't have the right properties. Mathematically, any particle having a particular charge is equivalent to a particle having the same mass and other characteristics with the opposite charge moving backward in time. And in fact, that was, I think, the reasoning that led Dirac to postulate the positron. I don't remember that history too well, but I think that was it. However, the tachyon would have other properties. For example, it would move faster than light. And antiprotons and positrons and antineutrons, which do exist, even though they have no charge, they have the opposite spin, you see. Those are all very definitely tardions. They move less rapidly than light. Okay, how about that, Gary?
Oh, I have two questions. One's Chris is very short. You mentioned that the possibility that gravitons could be Luxons.
Yes, they would have to be Luxons.
Well, they would have to be. And
do
you know of any...
As a matter of fact, I haven't time to go through this. It's one of the few things in physics that I really do understand, and I'd love to show you that I understand it, but it would take half an hour. But the fact that gravity has an inverse square property, you know, that it falls off as the inverse square of the distance from the gravitating object, is equivalent to the statement that the particles of gravity are Luxons. Light, you will notice, has the same property. Its intensity falls off as the inverse square of the distance from the object. That is, there's an r squared on the bottom of the fraction. And any such particles would fall off as the inverse square of the distance from their source. And if they did not have that kind of thing, that kind of property, they would not. It would be a different law. The particles which carry the various subatomic forces, the strong and weak forces, have finite rest mass,
and those forces do not have an inverse square law. They have a more complex law.
Well, the question I was getting at is that if the gravitational field of an object is dictated by its graviton, then if you could somehow remove the object or somehow change its energy so it would offer no gravitational effect, would the gravitational field decay at the speed of light?
Okay, I think you put it badly, but I see what you're getting at. You see, you can't simply remove an object's gravitational field without destroying its mass, which you can't do. The best you can do is convert it into energy, in which case the mass is still there and still has the same gravitational field. But let's do it a different way. Let's just say if you have a disturbance in a gravitational field, for example, by moving the gravitating object suddenly in a jerk, so that another object which was orbiting around it and being attracted by its gravity suddenly finds that the source of the gravity is in a different direction, probably at a different distance. You know, if you move it in a jerk, it's moved a little bit further away and that kind of thing. Does the other object move instantaneously, or can you say that it takes a certain length of time for the information that the gravitational field has changed to move out from the gravitating body to the object that's being attracted? And if so, how fast does it move? The answer is yes, it does take time for that information to move out, and it does move at the speed of light, and that is a consequence of the fact that gravitons would have to have zero rest mass. And I'll give you another example, complication. Electromagnetic waves, light, radio waves, all the others, which can be thought of as waves and as disturbances in electromagnetic fields, so that particular kind of waves, those waves can be generated by a charged object, which is to say an object capable of exerting the electromagnetic force, just as an object which has a mass is an object that is capable of exerting the gravitational force, okay? A charged object moving up and down. And so when WKAR broadcasts its carrier wave, they have an antenna, which is a big linear arrangement of a conducting material, and they send a pulse which makes the electrons in that antenna move up and down, up and down, up and down inside the antenna at a frequency of 90.2? Five million times every second. And that's what it means to say that the frequency of WKAR is 90.5 megahertz, which means million times per second. Okay? As they do that, suppose there's another electron somewhere nearby, for example, in the antenna of your radio. The fact that there are electrons over in the transmitting antenna, which are exerting an electromagnetic force on the electron in your antenna, means that the electron in your antenna is being attracted toward, I'm sorry, is being repelled by the electrons in the transmitting antenna. If those electrons move, then there is a change in the force that is felt by the electrons in your antenna, that change being in both magnitude and direction. And the effect of that change is if they're being repelled, you know, they move in the opposite direction, and so as the electrons in the transmitting antenna move this way, the electrons in your antenna move in the same way, back and forth, only out of phase. Well, it takes a certain length of time for the information that the transmitting antenna's field has changed to move through the space between that antenna and your antenna, and it turns out that the length of time is what it would take for that disturbance, that information, to move at the speed of light. And indeed, that is where the speed of light first came into physics, because Maxwell figured out that that would happen when he wrote the basic equations that describe electromagnetic fields at the end of the last century, and he kept getting this constant in his equations. And the constant, to his delight, turned out to be the speed of light which had already been measured. And then he began to realize that he was on to something, and that indeed, you know, his equations probably had something to do with physical reality. Heinrich Hertz was the one who specifically proposed, Maxwell figured this out as what light was, and Hertz said, okay, there ought to be much longer wavelength oscillations with much slower frequencies, which we could actually generate by moving electric currents back and forth in an antenna. In other words, he predicted radio waves, and he was right, and they were actually discovered when the apparatus was set up, and that is why we use the word hertz to mean one oscillation per second in that antenna. Okay, that disturbance also travels at the speed of light. Well, suppose you have a body which is capable of exerting not the electromagnetic but the gravitational force. In other words, it has a mass, and you make it bob up and down. Then it too will have the same effect on other masses in its vicinity. It'll make them bob up and down, and it will make them do so after a time delay that is describable by the assumption that that disturbance has traveled at the speed of light between the two bodies. Such a thing is called a gravitational wave. They should exist.
They haven't been proven, though.
And we've been looking for them for decades now. About a decade ago, Joseph Weber at the University of Maryland built himself a gravitational antenna, which was simply a big mass, which he freely suspended in such a way that it would move back and forth if a gravitational wave made it move. And the gravitational waves would be very, very low in energy because the gravitational force is extremely weak compared to the electromagnetic force. A little bitty dime store magnet can pick up a paperclip against the gravitational force of the entire Earth trying to pull it the other way. So the gravitational force is very, very weak. Nevertheless, using very sensitive detectors, he thought that he had detected a gravitational wave. Unfortunately, other people have built similar devices, some of them more sensitive, and have not been able to duplicate his results. He thought he even had the location of the gravitational wave source pinpointed. It was the center of our galaxy, where there may very well be very heavy masses. The problem is that there are other things that can make a freely suspended body on the surface of the Earth move, namely earthquakes, big and small. And there's always a certain amount of seismic background from trucks going by in the next county, from waves pounding on all the beaches of all the Earth, from atmospheric motions and so forth. And so the Earth is never seismically quiet. Therefore, Weber developed an experiment which was flown to the moon, which is very much more seismically quiet, no air, no water, very, very little internal seismic activity. And it was set up on the last Apollo flight as one of the ALSEP instruments. And it was the only ALSEP instrument that was ever set up which refused to work when it was turned on. And that was the last Apollo flight, so we had no other chance. Someday, perhaps, we will have an unmanned spacecraft or another manned mission, which will set up another one on the moon or some seismically quiet location, and then we may be able to get more definitive answers. They should exist, though. Every time an electron orbits around a nucleus, it should have produced electromagnetic waves, and it does. Every time a star orbits around another star, and there are certainly many, many double stars in our galaxy, they ought to produce gravitational waves. A black hole orbiting around another star would produce very intense gravitational waves because it has a very intense gravitational field. There are lots of sources out there that ought to do it. Someday we will detect gravitational waves unless there is something very wrong with our understanding of physics as I just outlined it to you.
Thank you.
You bet.
The second question I was going to ask is that you mentioned these creatures, black holes.
I'm going to give a whole lecture on them. What a black hole is. Well, it's coming up in March.
Well, I've got
it's right here on the schedule.
A small question in reference to the relativistic effect. I think I've got a fair grasp of what an observer on the outside would watch the unfortunate astronaut falling in a black hole, what he would see. But what would the unfortunate astronaut see completely, including when he got inside the black hole?
We cannot even in principle answer the question of what he'd see inside the black hole because even in principle there's no way he could report the information back. Okay. We can't observe a different situation. We can't observe, we're in a black hole but we're not in the singularity. That's what he's really getting at. In fact, there is no singularity in this case.
But when the astronaut approached up to the
event horizon in a short period. As a matter of fact, you're probably not going to even answer it in March because that's going to be a rather non-relativistic treatment of black holes, which of course is a very incomplete treatment. But I think the best answer I can give to you is you cannot discuss something that even in principle can't be observed. See? You can't say what would it look like if a whole universe looked like if I could travel faster than light and light couldn't catch up with me because although it's an interesting question, it's a meaningless question. You can't do it.
Well, I speak in reference as the astronaut approaches the event horizon.
Yeah, once he's inside the event horizon, he can't report it back even in principle, and so there is no way of ever finding out what the physical laws are inside a black hole. You can write the equations if you like and get some probably meaningless answers. For example, the time and space would interchange roles inside a black hole as seen by an outside observer, which is not possible even in principle, not as seen by the astronaut inside. When I say interchange roles, what I mean is that in normal space, you can be at the same place at two different times, but you cannot be at the same time at two different places. Inside a black hole, as seen by the outside observer, it would be just the other way around. You could be at the same time at two different places, but you could not be at the same place at two different times. That is lots of fun. It spices up a popular lecture. It is also meaningless because even in principle, it can't be verified.
Thank you.
Okay. Question over here.
Is there any particular quantity that has such units that would account why length was multiplied times that adjustment factor and time and mass was divided by that adjustment factor?
You're asking me now details of the mathematical derivation of these things. If you go through the mathematical derivation, you will see that it automatically falls out. It has nothing to do with the units. It'll work in whatever units you use as long as they're a consistent set of units. And if they're not consistent sets of units, then what you have to do is force them to be consistent by putting in appropriate conversion factors, and that's easy enough to do. That's really what we're doing with E equals mc squared. The c squared there is just a conversion factor because we're silly enough not to use the same units for both energy and mass. You know, so how many ergs is a gram? Well, it's c squared, where c is the speed of light in centimeters per second. Let me refer you to Einstein's book, which no one here will have any trouble understanding, especially after this introduction. You know, it's written for the general public, and Einstein is not one of these great scientists that can't explain it to people who are not great scientists. I don't think he's quite as lucid as Martin Gardner is, but you know, you'll get through it, I don't think, without very much trouble. And if you want to see the mathematical derivation, that's, you know, get it from the master.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
We were talking about black holes a minute ago, and Scientific America. Scientific America, I don't, 5 months ago perhaps, there was an article on tunneling from black holes,
okay.
And that was very, the description was very similar to the description you gave concerning a tachyon moving backwards in time and opposite charge.
No, I don't think it was.
Well, it talked about, it said something along the lines of positive matter falling into the star was roughly equivalent to antimatter coming out of the star.
Yeah.
Well, except that all information was being canceled.
Backward in time.
Exactly, excuse me.
So, you know, you see it the same way. Well, yeah, I mean, it is mathematically equivalent. You can write it that way if you want, you know. I mean, that seems to me to be an unnecessary complication, like writing the equations of your motion in a railroad train in such a way as you assume that the world is moving past you. But, you know, you can do it if you insist.
In other words, it's just a meaningless. They claim that that way you could get matter out of it. Because there was a further complication, the fact that this is where I begin to get very cloudy on what was said, but something along the line of the process of going in or out of the black hole will cancel all information in the matter itself, and so you can get it out and turn it back into positive matter and get a television out with no trouble at all. And in fact, they claimed anything could pop out at any time. And the complexity or information involved had something to do with how...
That's putting it a little strongly. There is a mechanism by which you can get particles to be created just outside a black hole. They're not literally coming from the black hole, although it's true that they come from its direction, since they come from just outside it, and also it's true that they wouldn't be there if the black hole didn't exist. But that's different from saying they actually come out of the black hole, and so far that's fairly theoretical. Well, so far black holes are fairly theoretical. I'll tell you, the whole thing about black holes at the moment, when you get to these more extreme mathematical derivations, it's just so far beyond the observations that all you're doing here is playing with the equations, and you don't know that you've got the right equations. You know that those equations are oversimplified with respect to the real world, because they have to be to make them easy to solve. And so, for example, when you started to say tunneling, I thought you meant the thing about how the equations say that if the universe closes in on itself, space-time closes in itself where there's a black hole, it opens up again on the other side. That's true only where you write equations that describe the structure of space-time and ignore the fact that there is something there that is causing the black hole in the first place, and which you'd have to pass through to get out this, quote, other side. You know, that's... There's nothing wrong with oversimplifying equations as long as you remember you've oversimplified them and don't use them in ways that are inappropriate to the simplification. So if I write the equation for the trajectory of a rifle bullet fired in the Earth's gravitational field that lands a few hundred feet away, it's simpler to write the equation if I assume the Earth is flat than if I take the curvature of the Earth into account, and it's perfectly valid to do that for such a tiny distance. But if I then take that equation and say, hey, look, I can prove that the Earth is flat, you know, that it goes on forever and ever, that it just doesn't curve, I'm just misusing it. I am bothered by a lot of cosmologists. It seems to me that they have a penchant for taking equations and just playing with them and then acting as though the results meant something, even though they have no observational data to base it on. There is there's a very sparse database in the whole science of cosmology. And I claim that is mysticism. And as such, abhorrent scientifically. It may be mysticism in which you're playing with meaningless equations instead of the normal kind in which you're playing with meaningless words, but it's just as meaningless and just as much intellectual cotton candy.
But relativity fell into that because it was quite a long time before relativity had practical observational results. A few years
ago. Not at all. Special relativity had practical observational results within a few years after Einstein published. General relativity is still in the process of being proved or disproved, and it may very well turn out to be wrong. The most recent observations were those that were made when Mars carried the four Viking spacecraft behind the Sun, and therefore the radio transmissions sent back and forth between Earth and the Viking spacecraft had to travel right through the Sun's gravitational field and got affected by it. And Einstein predicted that they would get bent by a certain amount, and Newton would have predicted a different amount, which was wildly different from what was observed. And then there's some other theories which could predict a whole range of amounts, from Einstein's value to something somewhat different. And what happened was they observed the value that Einstein predicted. Unfortunately, that doesn't prove that Einstein was right, as most of the press reports said at the time. What it proved was that he wasn't wrong, and that's a very different statement. Some of the other theories could give results consistent with that also. Here's a sort of weird case where a negative result would have been more valuable than a positive one. If you'd gotten a value significantly different from Einstein, some of the others could have been all right, but Einstein couldn't. But that's not the way it turned out. So, general relativity is still viewed with suspicion by many perfectly reputable physicists, or at least they're willing to entertain the possibility that it's wrong. I don't know of any reputable physicists who have any serious doubts. There's always the lurking doubt at the back of your head, you know, that anything could be wrong, but I don't know of any that have any serious doubts in their everyday working lives of the validity of special relativity, which I've been talking about tonight. And that started to be checked out just a few years after Einstein published
star position.
The eclipse of star positions is general relativity. There were three predictions of general relativity. There was the effect of the Sun's gravitational field, or anything else, but the Sun's the strongest we've got in the solar system, on a ray of light or a radio wave or whatever going past it, and that was checked out at the next total solar eclipse and the values were found to be about what Einstein said, and these Viking observations are just a great refinement of that. There was the advance of the perihelion of Mercury, which was exactly the amount that Einstein said that it would be, and there was a third one which was more complicated and wasn't something called the Mussbauer effect, which was not... I'm confusing that with something else. Anyway, a more complicated one that wasn't actually proved until the 1950s. And there are a number of others that you can derive from them. Historically, those three were the first ones. A number of other predictions that you can derive from them that haven't been tested out. The problem is the gravity, and you see special relativity is about gravity. Gravity is such a doggone weak force. It's very, very hard to study. You just can't get a strong gravitational force. You want a nice strong electromagnetic force? Fine, you can whip it up in the laboratory. You want a nice strong gravitational force? Well, you got to go to the Sun, and it's hard to observe something that is sitting next to the Sun for obvious reasons. And even the Sun's gravitational force isn't all that strong. What we need is a nice captive black hole somewhere in the solar system and a couple of laboratories out in free fall, where you don't have the Earth gravity always present as a weak but annoying background, and then we will begin to make some headway in understanding gravity and check out general relativity. What's this? Then you wouldn't know, you can't go faster than light.
Yeah,
and
people back on Earth would never know
whether
it was true or not anyway.
No, oh, that's your point. No, nearby interstellar space, a couple of light hours out. In fact, just an orbit around the Earth wouldn't do for a lot of purposes. No, the hard part is getting the captive black hole. But in fact, I'll tell you, in all seriousness, I think we're going to make tremendous strides in gravitational research as soon as we're able to do some of them in free fall. And that'll happen in the next decade, starting spaceflight. In fact, we almost had it with Skylab. There was one of the winners in that nationwide contest among high school students to propose experiments for Skylab was an experiment to study gravity. And it won. And the guy was, listed among the winners and everything else. The problem was that then the engineers finally decided, after they looked them all over, that the hardware was just too difficult and too delicate to build and to fly reliably in the short time period they had before launch, and so they scrapped it. But we'll do it one of these days, and I suspect it will be done in spaceflight. What was the actual experiment? I don't know the details of it. I know it existed, and I know that was the story, but I don't know exactly how it worked. What's that?
Something relating to free fall?
Yeah, it was some sort of investigation of gravity in free fall, where you didn't have the Earth's gravitational field. Well, I mean, you have it, but you don't have the effects of it as strongly. And I do not know the exact details of the experiment, since it was not flown. You know, it's hard enough to keep up with the ones that were. Okay, how about over there?
I'd like to ask you to explain, or maybe I should say describe, the Doppler shift.
Okay, Doppler shift is not necessarily relativistic. It happens even at low speeds. Basically, what Doppler shift is about is that if you have an object which is emitting waves of any sort, sound waves, light waves, anything, and those waves, when the object is at rest with respect to you, have a particular wavelength, then if it's moving away from you, the waves that reach you, here you are on the Earth, this is your eye, the waves that reach you have a longer wavelength than they would if the object were at rest. If it's moving towards you, the waves have a shorter wavelength than they would when the object's at rest. The reason for this is quite easy to understand. Consider an object which is at rest with respect to you. It's emitting waves. Here is one wave crest that it just emitted, surrounding it in a circle with the object that's doing the emitting in the center of that circle. Here is the wave crest that was emitted just before that. It's a concentric circle. The whole thing looks like a bullseye. Here is the wave crest that was emitted just before that. Again, it's concentric with the other two. Now consider an object that's moving with respect to you. It's moving away from you. Well, here is the wave crest that it's emitting right now. It's lying along the surface of the object. The wave crest that was emitted before that one, however, was not emitted when the object is in that position. It was emitted when the object was in some other position, say over there. And so the wave crest emitted immediately before that is centered not on the object's current position, but on the position where the object was when it emitted it. The wave crest that was emitted just before that one is centered on the position where the object was when it emitted that one, and so forth. Well, I think you can see that if the object is moving towards you, the wavelength is less than it would be if it were stationary. When it's moving away from you, the wavelength is greater than it would be when it's stationary. If the object is moving at some angle with respect to you, then if it's a 90 degree angle, the wavelength is going to be the same, and if it's not a 90 degree angle, it will be greater or lesser by an amount that's not fully as much as it was moving right towards you or away from you, some intermediate amount. And so you can calculate that. That's called the Doppler shift. A standard example of it is that you hear it with sound waves when an object is moving towards you. And everybody's had the experience of standing by a roadside and hearing, say, a truck coming towards you emitting sound waves at a particular frequency. And the pitch of a sound wave is correlated with the wavelength of the sound wave. The higher the pitch, the shorter the wavelength. So the truck comes along and it goes, right? High pitch, as it's higher than normal pitch as it's coming towards you, then it goes by you, and a lower than normal pitch as it's going away from you. If an object that's emitting light waves is moving towards you or away from you, what happens is the color of the waves changes, because color in light is correlated with wavelength. And so if the object is moving away from you, all of the wavelengths are lengthened. And what that means is that something which might have been blue is shifted down towards the red end of the spectrum, which is the long wavelength end of the spectrum. For that reason, that kind of Doppler shift is referred to as a red shift. It's a bad term, because it's not as though the things that are longer than red, which are infrared, turn around and go the other way and get shorter and move in towards red. You know, all of the wavelengths are lengthened. You can use that to measure the velocity of an object. If you don't take into account the relativistic corrections, the formula is very simple. The wavelength that you observe minus the wavelength that you would have observed if the object were stationary, which is lambda naught, divided by what the wavelength would have been when it was stationary, is equal to beta, the velocity expressed as a fraction of the speed of light. Lambda, the wavelength you observe, minus lambda naught, the rest wavelength, divided by lambda naught equals beta. In the relativistic case, it's a more complicated formula, and you have to worry about that only when the speed of recession is close to that of light with respect to you, and in most astrophysical cases, it's not. You get into some of the more distant quasars, and you have to worry about that. I don't remember the relativistic formula offhand, but you can look it up.
That's what I was wondering offhand is as you're approaching the speed of light, what effect that's going to be having on what you're seeing behind you. In other words, as you're speeding up to light, things that you have passed as you're increasing speed, are they being distorted?
Okay, if you're moving in an interstellar spaceship at some speed very close to that of light, as you look forward, you will see a phenomenal blue shift. And in fact, all the stars will be very bright, intensely blue. Larry Niven loves to write about this. All the wavelengths will be much shorter than they would have been. And furthermore, there's an effect called aberration, which is, since you're moving and the light waves are moving at a somewhat comparable speed, they seem to come in at a different angle than they would if you were stationary with respect to them, in the same way as when you're walking through a rainstorm, the raindrops, even if they're falling vertically, if you're walking, they seem to come in at an angle and you have to tip the umbrella forward if you don't want to get hit on the feet by the raindrops. And so the effect of that would be all the stars would seem to crowd forward into a relatively narrow region of the sky in front of you. There'd be this big band to the side in all directions, which would seem to be black, and then behind you there'd be all these reddened stars. And it would be an eerie sort of way to look. And navigation would drive you out of your mind, because you'd have to correct for your relative position, your relative speed with respect to the stars, if you're trying to find a particular navigation star.
That part of Star Wars would be correct, where he speeds up and you get that sort of a effect of the
stars. I don't remember anything in Star Wars offhand that showed that correctly. When he first took off,
when he left the planet.
Go faster than light, they first accelerate.
Well, when they go faster than light, I don't know what it looks like.
Yeah, then everything
went out. Yeah, okay.
When first the stars all went blue, bright blue.
Really? Gee, I forgot that one. All right. You mean they actually did something correctly in Star Wars?
They just kind of turned off the sky, basically.
They just kind of turned off the sky, all right.
Well, they made all these nice creeks before they
went off. Yeah, well, that's a different situation. The only thing I can think of offhand they did correctly in Star Wars was that beautiful double star sunset, which was done correctly, mainly because they did it by superimposing pictures of two real sunsets on the Earth. And so, I assume. And so the star that is closer to the horizon is more reddened and flattened by atmospheric effects than the one that is farther away. And that was very nice. And well, they're the same size. That's possible. Why not? You can't rule it out. There are, in fact, a lot of double stars in which the two stars are identical. Alpha Centauri is a good example.
Distances.
Yeah, different distances, but suppose they have to be the same distance from you because your distance from them is great compared to their distance apart. That's reasonable. I mean, you can't rule it out. You don't have to do as much special pleading as you do to have a lot of the other things in Star Wars come out right. What I want to know is how you manage to hear spaceships and weapons throughout the movie through total vacuum, you know, to start out with.
Didn't hear them.
Well, I complain if I do hear them. So.
In reference to the black hole idea, which I know you don't like talking about because it's totally vague, but and shortly put,
black holes are totally vague. In fact, they're very sharply defined.
Well,
we have seen sharpest defined objects in the universe
on paper.
At zero size. The singularity is at zero size.
Shortly put, why aren't we dead?
Why aren't we dead?
Because if these black holes have been around for so long, with such an intense gravitational field, which just pull all this.
They have intense gravitational fields nearby, but when you're at a distance from them, they have the same gravitational field as they would if the matter were not so spread out. If the body is spherical, then so long as you are outside the body itself, the gravitational field that you feel depends only on two things. That is, the mass of the object that's doing the gravitating, well, of course, your own mass is involved there, but I'm holding that constant. The mass of the body that's doing the gravitating and your distance from the center of the object. Suppose that the Earth could suddenly be contracted until it was half its present size. The Moon would keep orbiting in exactly the same orbit. All the artificial satellites would keep orbiting in exactly the same orbit. Everything would be the same. All that would change would be the surface gravity, that is to say the gravity at the new surface, which is now in a different position than the old one was, would of course be different. But the gravity at a given distance from the center would be exactly the same. Gravitationally, any spherical body, and all astronomical bodies are spherical after a certain size, any spherical body acts as though it were a black hole, that is to say, a point object whose location is the center of the real object and whose mass is the mass of the real object. That is true as long as you are outside the body. Now, you get inside the Earth, and the gravitational field you feel does not follow from that. That was first proved by Newton. First, he derived the law of gravity for the simple case where two bodies were points. And then he said, okay, if we're talking about moons and apples, we can't assume the Earth is a point. And what the Earth is a huge array of individual points. He didn't call them atoms, but let's use modern terminology and say so. Each of which has its own tiny little gravitational field, each of which is at a different distance from the apple or the moon, and they themselves are arrays of points at different distances. What's the sum of all those going to be? Newton suspected, his intuition was good enough to make him suspect that the answer was going to be what I said, that the body would act as though it were a point located at the center of the real object and having the mass of the real object, because the ones that are closest to you up here near the surface of the spherical body are fewer in number. The ones that are further away are greater in number, but they're a little bit further away, so they're not strong and so forth. He suspected all that would cancel out and would act like a black hole, but he didn't know it. Nowadays, anybody who knows integral calculus could prove it very easily within just a few days. Within just a few weeks of study of integral calculus. But Newton didn't have integral calculus. So he invented it to solve that problem. It took him 10 years. At the end of it, he had not only a theory of gravity, but also integral calculus. Quite a story. Okay, we got questions? Nobody else has a microphone. Then thank you very much, and I hope to see you next month.